I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There are two big reasons why lawmakers would be keen to collect the sales tax from online purchases in Missouri. First, state revenues are off by about $300 million. Second, it could level the field between brick-and-mortar retailers who already collect those taxes and their online counterparts who may not. Today, can your internet shopping help close Missouri's budget gap? Then, in the early 90s, Joshua Redman had a decision to make: Yale Law School or a career in jazz. He chose his saxophone and never looked back. Today, he's one of the scene's most renowned horn players, and he's bringing his ensemble to Kansas City. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Is it time for Missouri to start collecting sales taxes from online purchases? Some say absolutely in the wake of a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court ruling. It's hardly lost on anybody that Missouri government faces enormous challenges this year, with revenues off by about 5% or maybe $300 million. Unless something changes soon, deep cuts could be in the offing for K-12 education as well as the state's university system. One other big argument for taxing online sales, it would level the playing field between brick-and-mortar retailers who now collect those taxes and big online retailers who some say enjoy an unfair advantage. With us to talk about this is Tracy Gleason. She's Vice President for External Relations for the Missouri Budget Project. That's a left-leaning think tank. Tracy, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So online retailers operating in Missouri don't charge sales taxes? I think that's going to surprise some people.
Well, some over time some have do, begun yeah. to. It all dates back to a 1992 Supreme Court ruling before any of us could sit here on our phones and order a new iPhone or whatever we want online, basically. And in 1992, the Supreme Court said, hey, unless you have a business interest in a state, it's against interstate commerce to start charging out-of-state businesses taxes. The economy has changed a lot, but our tax system hasn't caught up. So while some large retailers charge those taxes, there's a lot still that goes uncollected by the state of Missouri.
And there was a U.S. Supreme Court ruling a year ago that seemed to change things a little bit.
Right. In Wayfair and South Dakota, the online giant Wayfair, it was allowed. South Dakota was allowed to start collecting those taxes. It's under very limited circumstances, but our state, Missouri, hasn't caught up. About half of other states do collect those taxes, but we still have that loophole in place.
You know, explain to us how this gives online retailers an advantage over the brick and mortar shops, Tracy.
You hear a lot of people and a lot of local business owners actually talking about how people will come use their local store as almost a showroom for a big online giant. So they will go, they will touch, they will feel the merchandise, they will ask questions, then they'll go back and buy it online to save whatever the sales tax percentage might be. And so a lot of the local businesses feel like, hey, we do this at the point of sale, we collect, we do all of this. Why should someone who is out of state, who's using resources, putting wear and tear on local roads and bridges, why should they get this economic advantage that's been given to them by the state?
To what extent are the brick-and-mortar retailers then actively lobbying for the sales tax to be put in place?
Sure. There's been a lot of local chamber interest. This year, there's a lot of cities, local chambers, the Missouri Retailers Association, the Missouri Municipal League, the Associated Industries who have said, hey, this is something whose time has come.
If our listeners want to chime in here on this notion of paying sales taxes for online purchases in Missouri, what do you think of that idea? 816-235-2888 is our number here, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. So going back to that Supreme Court ruling a year ago, it's called the Wayfair fix. Why is it called that?
Right. Again, it was a Supreme Court decision in Wayfair versus South Dakota. So that's just become the shorthand for the fix. And I want to point out that this is a tax that is already owed to the state in most circumstances. There's a dollar limit, but as a consumer, you and I are supposed to keep track of what online purchases we've made, whether we've paid taxes on them, and then figure out what taxes are owed and remit them to the state. Surprisingly, a handful of people actually do that. Most people have no idea they're even supposed to. So this isn't a new tax. It's just closing that loophole and making the collection mechanism the same. So the onus is no longer on the consumer.
How did the case wind up in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Wayfair said, hey, South Dakota, you know, they passed this law that said if you do enough dollar sales in their state, they wanted to be able to collect taxes. Wayfair enjoyed that competitive advantage they had, and so they challenged it, wound up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court didn't overturn its 1992 decision, but said, hey, so what South Dakota is doing is okay. So Missouri does want to be very careful in how they craft it, but we have enough examples from other states that it is pretty easily doable. And given the volatile revenue situation in Missouri and our struggle to pay for the very services that our communities need to thrive, the time has come.
You know, Missouri has been operating under a different standard, Tracy, that determined whether sales taxes had to be paid. What was that standard? This notion that you had to have a brick and mortar structure in the state already or something like that?
Yeah, and that is left over from long ago, and that goes back to the original Supreme Court decision. So they said, and so, you know, if you're going to buy online from a Walmart, there's clearly Walmart stores throughout the state. So if someone has a warehouse or a local retail chain or that kind of thing, then no matter what, they collected those sales taxes on the purchase. You saw it on your receipt. You remitted it. But if you bought from elsewhere, and it used to be Amazon was in this situation. I've lost track of when Amazon started collecting those sales taxes. So in Missouri still, if you're an out-of-state retailer that sells $200,000, $500,000 in Missouri, you don't have to do any of it, and it's on the consumer.
That's interesting. Now, Missouri residents who purchase more than $2,000 a year from out-of-state suppliers in a calendar year, they're already supposed to file what's called a use tax return during the calendar year there. Does anybody do that?
Surprisingly enough, 20-some-odd Missourians did it a few years ago when we checked. Don't know.
20 as in fewer than two dozen.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
So
there's probably a lot more than
a lot more that owed it. But so not a lot of people are doing it. And again, it goes back to treating the government giving out-of-state retailers an advantage over our local mom-and-pop stores that sponsor youth leagues, that donate for fundraisers, that give a lot back to their communities, and they're put at an economic disadvantage.
But some folks might say, well, there's already a mechanism in place for Missourians to declare and pay these taxes. But the point is, not very many of them are doing it.
Not many people do it. And why should it be put on Missourians, most of whom don't know that they're supposed to do it, as opposed to let's just treat the businesses the same?
So with this ruling, states can now require internet sellers to collect state sales tax and then turn it over to the state. That's what we're talking about here, right?
Correct. The bills would do it in slightly different ways. There's a couple of major bills that are currently one in the House and one in the state Senate that would address this issue. One is sort of a clean bill, if you will, that just looks at this issue. The other bill is pretty problematic in terms of some of the other changes that it makes that would make our state tax structure more regressive. Put education funding at risk and cost the state of Missouri money in the long term.
Do we have any idea how much revenue this could mean for the state of Missouri if this gets implemented?
So it's difficult to judge because there have been a lot of changes in what has been collected. A U.S. General Accounting Office report from about a year and a half ago is kind of the latest
benchmark
that people have confidence in. They gave kind of a low estimate and a high estimate. So if you look at that low estimate, which is a pretty conservative estimate, for state and local money, it would be about $180 million. So it would be about closer to $100 million total state general revenue, including earmarked funds.
So that would be about a third of the shortfall that the state is now experiencing just in round terms.
Right, right.
So it'd be a significant step forward.
Yes. Yeah. It's not a panacea to fix budget and revenue problems that have been instituted over a period of years, but it is something that will continue to grow and needs to be taken care of.
Is it time to start charging online sales taxes in Missouri? That's our topic. Let's go to some calls at 816-235-2888. David from Peculiar, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, I'm sorry, but I'm tired of tax hike Mike Parsons and this Republican legislature always trying to raise my taxes. There's all kinds of people that get tax breaks in Missouri. People who drive large pickup trucks that don't have to pay for the same plates that I pay for. And the Republicans passed a tax hike or a tax cut for wealthy people in the state of Missouri a few years ago. So obviously they have no problem. They didn't need money. So if we don't need money, why are we taxing internet sales, which goes on the burden of working people like me?
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree that there have been some tax changes over time that have been targeted towards corporations and the very wealthiest of Missourians. And that's a problem because Missouri's tax structure is unfair to low and middle income working Missourians. That said, I do take issue with the idea that Missouri doesn't need the money. We have seen numerous critical services in Missouri decline over time. And I think one of the differences you see is when Kansas had its tax cuts a few years ago that passed in 2012, there was a sudden impact, and people saw that and made their voices heard. And Kansas overturned those cuts because they couldn't fund education. They couldn't fund their roads. They couldn't fund their infrastructure. In Missouri, we're like that frog in a frying pan. It's happening. It's been a little bite at a time. And so we become used to the status quo. So there has been this decline. They are the legislature, for instance, is fully funding K-12 education now. But they moved the goalpost. They cut substantially the amount that they said they were going to fund it as of a few years ago. And while they're fully funding what's called the education formula, they are not fully funding school transportation. That has declined dramatically over time. So if you can't get kids to school, then you can't teach them. So districts are using having to backfill their transportation money, and that those dollars aren't going into the classroom. So that's one example. We have had these cuts over time. We do need to look at broader things in the Missouri tax system to make sure it's more fair. But again, this isn't a new tax, and it's closing a loophole.
I was going to say, and I work in higher education in Missouri, and I can speak firsthand, there hasn't been a lot of love shown to that part of the state budget either in recent years. David, thank you for the phone call. Let's go to Kristen from the South Plaza neighborhood. Good morning.
Hey, Dave, it's Kristen. I work in retail now and have been for the last 4 years. And so prior to that, I felt like I don't want to be taxed for any online shopping. But I see firsthand on a daily basis how people come in, use the store to assess the product, and then they in the store are online looking at Amazon and other sites to where they can buy it for cheaper. But we've done all the work with them. And so we're talking about not just, you know, what this would do for tax purposes, but stores are closing because they can't make a sale because people just go home and buy it online or that night when they're at midnight when they decide, I think I'll get it here. So I think it affects the economy locally because you're not shopping locally anymore. So if we don't have that option for paying salaries for people and they're, you know, contributing back into the economy, into the local economy, then what else can we do but tax them at the point of sale?
So you see this kind of negotiation going on in customers' mind pretty often. They come into your store and then they go online and look elsewhere to buy it cheaper.
Yeah, so that was at, I work at two stores, and one of them has since closed on the plaza.
Wow.
And that's what happened all the time there. On the other one, they do their online shopping and then just return stuff to us, and that's fine because they buy our product. But yeah, it absolutely happens on a daily basis in stores where products, you know, you can buy them online and you can try to find it. And then, you know, we even have people who would bring them in and say, oh, you know, I got this online, not from us. And, you know, do you know how we can get that fixed or can I return it here? I'm like, no, you can't return a KitchenAid product to this store when you bought it, you know, online at some wholesaler.
Right.
So it affects everything locally.
Thanks for the call, Kristen. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
You too. Bye.
Let's go to Joey from Blue Springs. Well, I think I just lost Joey. Maybe Joey can call back at 816-235-2888. You know, Tracy, if Missouri takes this route, would the state have to pass corresponding tax cuts because of the Hancock Amendment? And maybe you should explain what the Hancock Amendment is here.
Sure. The Hancock Amendment passed late 70s, early 80s, I believe, a couple different pieces of it. But it limits the amount that the legislature can raise taxes without going to a public vote. And so I referenced the Kansas example earlier where the Kansas legislature took action to fix their mistake. That often gets in the way of Missouri in terms of its broader income tax changes that if Missouri realizes down the line that they're not sustainable, which they're not, they can't turn them back. However, this, to get back to your question, this does not go against Hancock because, again, it is not a new tax.
Okay.
And so it's something that should be collected anyway.
You know, I get this notion, Tracy, that the General Assembly is controlled by Republicans who, you know, traditionally are less eager to impose new taxes. But given the financial challenges facing the state, why aren't they jumping on this? What's your sense?
There are a lot of flat anti-tax legislators who are wary of anything tax-related. The problem with this issue this year is that there are some proposals that would close this loophole, but as you mentioned, they would then turn around and further cut income taxes. So they're responding to it as a windfall rather than money that Missouri desperately needs in order to make its budget.
What is Governor Mike Parson, the state's still relatively new governor? He's a Republican. What does he think about this idea?
He hasn't been real active on it this legislative session. Prior to when the session began in January, he did talk about that because he really was prioritizing workforce development and other issues that require money to implement. And so he talked about it at that point as something that could help pay for that.
Joey from Blue Springs joins us now. Joey, good morning. I'm sorry I cut you off, Joey. It's my fault.
That's okay.
Think.
No problem. Yeah. No problem.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a topic that's pretty near and dear to my heart. I called on a lot of local businesses and saw it firsthand how it was affecting some of them. But I think it's just about evening up the playing field and bringing things back that if you buy it online, you're going to pay a tax. If you buy it locally, you're going to pay a tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the statistic that was given in Blue Springs when we tried to pass the use tax last year that stuck with me was that UPS and FedEx are bringing those things to people's homes, but those taxes aren't paying for the infrastructure and the roads to get them there.
Right.
So you're essentially wearing down your neighborhood by buying things out of town.
So how much money would it mean to Blue Springs, Joey? Do you recall?
I don't. I don't know what the specific numbers were, but...
But it's real money.
I know that it's real money, and as I'm driving on roads that are not the best, that if that's... even a little bit of money towards that, I think it's worth it.
Yeah. Joey, thanks for the call. And, you know, Tracy, we're running a little short of time, but there are bills in the General Assembly that would put this tax into place. There's one in each chamber. What are the chances of passage this session? Do you have any feel for that?
You know, it's challenging because on the Senate side, things have really slowed down in terms of their work. I'm hoping, you know, the House sent a budget over to the Senate last week that is based on revenue estimates that currently we're not close to meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as the Senate takes up that budget and realizes, hey, we either need to do something on the revenue side or start making a whole lot of cuts to what the House passed and to what people are expecting and to what our communities need.
Why is the state budget so underfunded right now? I mean, what's happening that we're seeing this 5% drop-off in revenue collections this year? Because that's a big chunk of money. Again, I said in the opening, $300 million roughly.
Right. Yeah, and there's a lot of factors that go into it.
Yes.
There's been a lot of confusion at the Department of Revenue on how federal tax changes impacted Missouri, what withholdings were, so tax money hasn't come in at the rate that was expected. Some people who've never owed do owe. People don't know what to expect in terms of refunds, but those are slow going out. So there's confusion on the about the impact of the federal tax side. But Missouri, again, over time, that frog in the frying pan has cut on the revenue side. And we're in the middle of implementing large tax cuts that are draining what we need to fund our schools and our roads and social services. taxes.
These are cuts that were passed several years ago and still only going into effect today as we sit here.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Tracy Gleason again, Vice President for External Relations for the Missouri Budget Project. Tracy, thanks for the good information. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back, jazz great Joshua Redman joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with Quentin Lucas and Jolie Justice, the mayoral candidates who will face off in June's general election for Kansas City mayor. Hear more about winners and losers in the primary election. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Well, for Joshua Redman, the pivotal moment of his life very well may have come in the early 1990s when the choices before him were law school at Yale University or a career in jazz. Redman chose the latter, and he was off to the races in a way that few jazz artists ever are. In 1991, he won first place in the Thelonious Monk International Jazz Competition and landed a recording deal with Warner Brothers. 2 years later, he made his solo debut with an album that earned him a Grammy nomination. In years since, he's recorded with Lee Summit's Pat Metheny, Yo-Yo Ma, Brad Meldow, and Chick Corea. He remains a top-line star in the jazz world, and he'll be in town with his quartet a week from tonight at the Folly Theater. The group's new album is just out. It's called Come What May, and here's the second track, I'll Go Mine. Joshua Redman, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So here you are in the early 1990s as a freshly minted grad of Harvard University. You get accepted at one of the finest law schools in the world at Yale, but you chose your saxophone and a career in jazz. Just guessing here, did some of your friends think you were crazy?
All my jazz friends did, that's for sure.
They knew what you were getting into, right?
I was a little crazy. You're supposed to be a little crazy when you're 22, right?
That's right.
I mean, you know, I was incredibly fortunate. I had these amazing opportunities. I moved to New York when I was 22. I just graduated and was going to enter law school a year later. I was taking, I don't know what they call it, like a gap year, just a break. And I moved to New York and kind of at the last minute moved into a house with a bunch of musicians that I'd met in the Boston area. They just needed someone else to, they needed someone to sleep on the living room floor and help lower the rent. within a couple weeks of being in New York, I mean, I was just swept up in the scene, and I had the opportunity to play with, you know, some of the greatest musicians, both my peers and masters of the music, people I've been listening to from a very young age. So I guess it was kind of a non-decision. It was the easiest decision I ever made. It was almost like the decision was made for me.
Well, I should point out, you know, your dad was Dewey Redman, a highly regarded tenor man over the years. Your mother was a dancer. So you grew up in a musical, artistic household. But describe for us the pull that music had on you, Josh.
Sure. Well, I mean, music has always been an essential part of my life, an essential part of my being from a very young age. For as long as I can, I mean, you know, it's always been something that's given me tremendous joy and a sense of connectedness and belonging. But I would say for up until that point, my relationship with music was more as a listener than as a player. I never took You know, I took a lot of things in life seriously, and I had a lot of like discipline with certain things, but music was not one of them. I never thought I was going to be a professional musician. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, playing music was always just like, it was like a release. It was play. It was something that I just did to kind of, I grew up, I was kind of like a, you know, nerdy introverted child, but like music was where I could shine, you know. Mm-hmm. Music was where I was like my most gregarious, my most social. It was never part of whatever life plans I made for myself up until that point.
Well, maybe you're explaining the answer to my next question. When you graduated from Harvard, I was struck by the fact that even though you were sort of raised with music, your degree at Harvard wasn't a music degree. You were a social studies major. Should I have been surprised then by that?
Should you have been surprised
by your choice of major? Yeah.
I was kind of just trying to figure it all out. Of course, I mean that's also something that you do in those years. I mean, I'm still trying to figure it all out. By the way,
join the crowd.
I haven't figured out anything more in the intervening 30 years.
Yeah.
I thought I wanted to be a doctor. And I entered as a pre-med, but that's not a major. It just means that you take the four courses you have to take in order to apply to med school. But then kind of somewhere in there, I got interested in kind of urban studies and sociology. And I also decided, I realized that I wanted to be a physician, and I realized that I wouldn't be a good physician because really I can't deal with pain and suffering at all. my own for certainly not, but no one else's either. I was really interested in sociology, but and my major was kind of an interdisciplinary social sciences major. Mm-hmm. But like many, I think, kind of students at that time, if you didn't know what you really wanted to do, you kind of applied and went to law school. And so that's the track that I was on. I didn't really want to be a lawyer, but it seemed like a good idea when I didn't have an idea of what I wanted to do.
The Joshua Redman Quartet performs at the Folly Theater next Thursday evening at 8 o'clock. I'll be talking with him at a pre-concert conversation at 7, so come on down and you can listen to that conversation there. More information and tickets, follytheater.org. So what did your parents want you to do with your life?
I should also mention that I did not grow up with my father. My father and mother were never married. I was raised only by my mom. Mm-hmm. I grew up with my father's music. I grew up with all his records, and I would listen to his music all the time. And I would see him whenever he'd come to town. You know, I'd go to his concerts. But I had very little relationship with him growing up. You know, I probably in the 18 years that I was living growing up in Berkeley, California, I probably saw him maybe 10 times. You know, and so I knew my father through his music. It was really, really my mom that raised me and kind of exposed me to everything. And I got to know my father much better after I moved to New York. In fact, he invited me to play with his band, and that was one of the bands that I worked regularly with for the first couple of years that I was in New York. Both my parents were very supportive of everything that I did and my choices. My father, when he found out that I wasn't going to go to law school, he said, "Are you sure?" You know, he thought I was crazy. You know, I mean, he would know, right? I mean, he was, you know, here's this, in my opinion, one of the great tenor saxophonists of his time and of any time, and incredible jazz musician, and so brilliant artist, well, so respected and revered within his community, but he had to struggle to pay the rent and to put food on the table. And he knew as well as anybody else the trials and tribulations of being, you know, a committed creative modern jazz artist. I think he was more leery of my career choice. Right. You know, my mom was like, "Go for it." they both really supported me. And I should also add, you know, I've been super lucky. I've had it so easy compared to so many jazz musicians out there. You know, I mean, I feel like I've paid my dues, and I continue to pay my dues in many ways, you know, in emotional ways and spiritual ways.
Right, right.
But you know, from, you know, the pure kind of hard economic facts, I mean, I moved to New York, and within, you know, a couple months of living there, I was able to support myself playing, you know, modern acoustic jazz music.
Right,
that's
right.
That's rare.
Well, I was really struck by that because you did get off to such a fast start. You win the Thelonious Monk competition. You get the Grammy nomination. You work with Pat Metheny and Chick Corea pretty early on. Was the fast start a blessing or a curse?
Well,
the expectations were high for you. Yeah.
You know, everything in life has you know, a flip side. I think a little of both. I mean, I could never call it a curse. I would have to say, kind of objectively, it was a blessing. Like I said before, I mean, mm-hmm. It's just super lucky. You know, I kind of bypassed the certain dues paying phase that many jazz musicians at the time have to go through. You know, kind of just grinding it out and trying to figure out how to make it work and make ends meet in New York City. As far as expectations. You know, I've never really paid, you know, I set really high standards for myself. I'm definitely my own worst critic. It's kind of been the motivating engine for my life is right. A certain form of, well, I don't want to go as far as say self-hatred, but, you know, I'm very, very good at, recognizing my weaknesses and you know, it's impossible for me to see whatever so-called strengths I might have.
That's
so, yeah, I've never, you know, I've never really felt the pressure of expectations from the outside. I guess the one thing that was difficult was, you know, all I wanted to do when I moved to New York and when I realized I wanted to play was just play with as many great musicians as I could, and that's what I've tried to do. You know, but when you have a career, and I saw that I was able to have a career, you know, as a recording artist and as a leader, you know, maybe some of those options in terms of just being able to play with whomever I wanted at any time. I mean, just being, I wasn't able to be available as, you know, someone that as a sideman that someone could call at any time, you know. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, there's a certain kind of gestational period that a lot of musicians get to have where they're not even worried about like leading their own bands or recording their own albums, and they just get to, you know, work with whomever calls them. And you know, I've kind of, you know, I had a different path. But yeah. It's a blessing. It's all, music is a blessing. Jazz music is a blessing, for sure.
Joshua Redman performs a week from tonight at the Folly Theater. Tickets at follytheater.org. Let's listen to just a bit more of Joshua Redman's new album, Come What May. This track is Circle of Life. You know, this album is a reunion of sorts for you. You've reunited with your longtime colleagues, pianist Aaron Goldberg, bassist Ruben Rogers, drummer Gregory Hutchinson. They'll all be with you, I think, in Kansas City. Why did you want to work with them again?
Oh, well, these are three of my favorite musicians on the planet.
Yeah,
and three of the musicians that I've been working with for the longest time. I mean, I've probably logged more hours on and off the bandstand, on the road with these musicians than with anyone else. And we started working together as a band in 1998, and we worked solid for 4 years. Recorded a couple records together, and in the intervening years we've continued to work together in a variety of contexts and as a quartet and also in other forms, but the kind of 20 years went by where we hadn't recorded a record, and it was just time. You know, I'd written a lot of new music and we'd been playing the music, and you know, when you get to work with the same musicians for that long, you just develop a trust and an empathy and just a genuine love for one another that allows you to be relaxed and free in the moment making music. And that is the ultimate in jazz and improvised music, you know.
Yeah.
No matter how rigorous the music that you're playing is, no matter how hard it is and the music that we play, you know, it's very challenging. We want to be in the groove. We want to be in the flow. We want to be in the moment, and we want to feel free, because then we can really tell our stories and make make a meaning out of that moment. That's improvised music, and so, you know, when I get to play with musicians that I'm that connected with, I can be my most natural and my most free.
You know, over the years, I just wanted to ask you, you've played with so many remarkable people, and I wanted to throw some names of some of them out at you. And tell us, if you would, in just a little, in a few words, what you enjoyed working with them most about. How about Yo-Yo Ma?
Well, first of all, I'm not a man of few words.
That's not going to happen, eh?
This is going to be my hardest test of the week. Just joy, you know. I mean, he just the joy that he has in music. I mean, he's obviously a genius and can do anything on his instrument. One of the greatest cellists of all time. But just this kind of like childlike, innocent joy that it's so infectious.
How did you wind up with him?
You know, there was a. There was a. It was. They called me to be a part of the Arthur. I had no idea what Arthur was. The PBS TV show that was produced by WGBH in Boston. Mm-hmm. I walked into the studio. They said, "Oh yeah, we're going to be doing an episode we want jazz and classical music, so we want you to play sax." And I walk into the studio and Yo-Yo Ma's there. He's the classical musician.
Wow.
It was crazy. Yeah. But I was young, younger. Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, and 25 or 26. It's like, oh, wow. That's Yo-Yo Ma. Wow. Okay, cool. Let's go.
Okay. Let's do this. Yeah. Yeah. How about Pat Metheny, who hails right here from the Kansas City area?
Well, I mean, Pat, I mean, I owe so much to Pat. You know, Pat is one of the musicians that I got to work with, one of the master musicians that I got to work with very early on. You know, and really he took me under his wing. You know, he didn't know me at all. I was recording something in the studio, and he was recording in the same studio, and he came down. And I mean, he, of course, knew my dad, and he knew a lot of musicians in my dad's circle very well, like Charlie Hayden and Billy Higgins and a lot of people who are associated with Ornette Coleman. He came down and I guess like heard a tune that we were working on in the studio, and he was like, "Hey man, we should play together." And I was like, "Oh wow. Yeah, I'd love to play with you." And then the next thing I know, he's calling me to go on the road with him, and then I get to record at my first recording session.
Wow.
Of my own was with him and Charlie and Billy, and then I went. Yeah, I mean, he went on the road. We went on the road together as a quartet, and it was his gig, but he allowed it to be called the Joshua Redman Quartet. It was crazy. I mean, wow. He's a total virtuoso and, one of the most influential guitarists of all time. He's a melodic genius. Mm-hmm. You know, he just has this ability to create melodies out of anything, anywhere, anytime. And I learned so much musically from him, but I also learned a lot at a very, very important time, you know, very early time, a lot about just how to be a good person in the jazz world and in the jazz business, you know, because
that's interesting.
There are a lot of, you know, as a young jazz musician, you could see there were a lot of sort of ways of kind of positioning yourself to the outside world, and there was this kind of model of the jazz musician who maybe like was, I don't want to say disdainful, but you know, wary and maybe kind of confrontational with whatever, you know, the jazz press or the jazz business, and rightfully so. I mean, jazz musicians had been exploited, especially African American jazz musicians.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is a music that people died for, that they fought for, and you know, and musicians have been you know, brutalized, you
right.
know, for just trying to play their music. But the one thing that I noticed about Pat Metheny,
I've got about 10 seconds left, Josh. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was just a good person to everyone and humble, and I learned a lot from him.
Hey, we're going to continue this conversation on the stage of the Folly Theater a week from tonight. Joshua plays at 8. I'll be talking to him at 7. Tickets at follytheater.org. What a thrill to have you, Joshua. Enjoy your tour, and I'll see you in a week, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
They say life is a lion, love is despair. Your heart never stopped trying. When you cut off your hair, a monkey on your shoulder, blood and broken bone. Your colors were bolder than the brightest rainbow.
Well, look who's here, Brian McTavish, to talk about some neat stuff to do on the big weekend coming up. How are you?
Hey.
Welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to be welcomed back by you. Okay, we have a lot of stuff to cover, so we're going
at
breakneck weekend fun pace.
Let's
do it. That's a little ditty about Frida Kahlo, mm-hmm. who is the famous eccentric modern artist.
Right.
And she will be celebrated in the musical, theatrical, and culinary kickoff of the traveling exhibit called Frida Kahlo's Garden. This is from 6 to 10 on Saturday. This is an evening that kicks off the whole exhibit, which you can go see at Powell Gardens, of course, in Kingsville, Missouri. There's a whole bunch of stuff to do. They've got entertainment. They've got music from folk and rock singer Maria the Mexican. They have a performance by KC playwright and actress Vanessa Severo, who actually later this month will star in her own one-woman show, Frida, a Self-Portrait at KC Rep. And Chef, KC Chef Renee Kelly, will give a quick walkthrough of the exhibit talking about the influence of food on Kahlo's art, including the chef's Frida-style appetizer menu. Wow. Give me more flan. That's what I say.
All right.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bit.
Man, I love that stuff.
Who doesn't?
That's fun.
Okay,
that's
we have several very different but very well worth your time things to do on First Fridays in the Crossroads Arts District. Let's start with Johnny Cash. There's an exhibit there on Friday night from 6 to 8 in the Crossroads. It's called 1968, A Folsom Redemption. And it, of course, consists of, not of course, I'm telling you, it consists of photos and memories that two reporters culled while attending Cash's historic 1968 show at at California's Folsom State Prison. Check out those really cool photos at the Mid-America Arts Alliance from 6 to 8.
That sounds great.
Then you can check out Finest Folk First Fridays featuring vocalist Julia Haley. It's sort of a listening room concert at the offices of the Folk Alliance International. There in the Crossroads. She'll do it twice, 6:30 and 7:30. That's Friday in the Crossroads. And last, but certainly not least, there's something called Broken Panels. It's a First Friday's art show by 10, count them 10, local comic book creators, including Josh Carter, he's fantastic, and Hector Casanova, he is fantastic.
Oh, Hector, yes.
Hector. Get there at 5 o'clock at Lifted Spirits Distillery in the Crossroads. Next.
Be sure to see Brian's 8 grab bag things to do in Kansas City this weekend. You'll find it at kcur.org. We'll be right back.
rider.
Oh, I like that song.
I'm doing well.
I'm just moving all over the place here. I can't move any more than I'm moving.
I'm performing well for you today, or at least this list is okay. Some low riders and who knows how many hundreds or even thousands of cars, trucks, and motorcycles will be on gleaming display with their sure-to-be beaming owners at this year's Street Car Takeover.
Wow.
It's from 11 in the morning for 12 hours until 11 at night, Saturday, rain day Sunday. And for the first time, it's happening at Arrowhead Stadium. Hmm. So, you know, you've got all these cars, beautiful cars. You've got live bands, DJs, food trucks, and loads of what I like to call motor vehicle-related vendors.
Okay.
Also, it's for charity. Taking It to the Streets and Warriors for Freedom. Those two organizations, they benefit.
Everything right is wrong again. Just like in a long, long trailer. All the dishes got broken. The car kept driving. And now that it would stop to savor. Wake me when the tower touched my face. Tell me everywhere.
And this is, what are we talking about? What is this?
Here we go. Everything and then some goes wrong in the play called The Play That Goes Wrong. Mm. Okay? It's on stage Thursday through Sunday at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. And it's a hit Broadway stage comedy. Basically, belly laughs. You will have one. I will have two because that's how I am. Because everything in the show is terribly askew. Basically, it's a self-aware community theater troupe, and it's an awful performance. I mean, every terrible thing happens. They're trying to put on a whodunit on stage, but it's so absurdly creative that even if you're not a belly laugher, you'll be smiling wider than when you came in. I assure you of that. So I would highly recommend The Play That Goes Wrong. If you don't laugh, ask for your money back.
Oh, sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
And finally today.
Sunday morning ever, and Sunday passing by. I'll be working here forever, at least until. Damn if you do, damn if you don't. I'm supposed to get a raise next week, you know that when I won't. Working for a living, working for a living.
That's Huey Lewis in the news.
Yeah, Huey, he's got tinnitus.
Oh, does he?
And hearing problems.
Oh,
we may never
bad.
See him or hear him again.
Well,
but
he was something.
But he
yeah.
was something, and that's a great record. Okay,
yeah.
I'm playing this because Odd Jobs. This is a themed show-and-telling event. I'll say it again. Show-and-telling event that features job-related personal objects and the stories behind them. If you're a mail carrier, you bring something about that and you tell a crazy, funny, weird, helpful story about it and so on and so forth. 7:30 tonight. Go to the Brick at 7:30 tonight. Downtown KCMO. Maybe bring something weird or odd from your job. And last but not least, finally, Serve KC Volunteer Fair. You know, volunteerism, it's a key to a successful community.
There you go.
I should do more of it.
You should. We all should.
You do a lot of it.
Yeah.
You do. But Serve KC Volunteer Fair, you can connect, and you should connect, with more than 40 local nonprofit organizations. They're all looking for working volunteers. So come on down there, 6 to 8 p.m. Saturday at Union Station. Have fun.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekly weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Tomorrow on the show, the concerns of Midwestern states over coming changes to donor liver distribution. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, a mother asking Kansas lawmakers for a chance to administer a CBD-THC oil combination for her daughter. Hear why she says the banned substance could save her child's life. You'll find it at KCUR.org. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.